Check. Oh, I got two channels for a second. Check.
Yeah, we need to fundraise for a new aux cable for this.
It's tough out.
Sign up at patreon.com/theantifada. We'll use your $5 for a new aux cable.
If you like our content, it'll be even better if we can hear ourselves through both of our ears. What's this 4-hour YouTube thingamajiggy you're talking about?
Yeah, so last night there was a really cool, you know, DIY guerrilla punk show in Brooklyn. It was a Palestine benefit and really good hardcore bands playing. And I decided instead to stay in and watch the 4-hour Star Wars Hotel review YouTube essay.
Why the shit did you do that? It was raining pretty bad last night, in your defense.
That was not in my defense. It stopped raining around 8:30 or something. Well, for one, I've been to the Star Wars land in Disneyland and really liked it and had a really interesting experience there.
Wait, back up a second. Hold on. So at Disney World, you can have a Star Wars experience and there's a hotel. Is that what I got so far?
Yeah, it's not at Disneyland. It's at Disney World.
The Florida one, yeah.
And yeah, the Star Wars land at Disneyland and Disney World is pretty cool. Like, it's got good rides, good immersive experience. And I always wondered what the hotel would be like, but it costs like $6,000 a room for like a... But it's like a LARP. It's like, you know, you're at the hotel, there's actors, there's like storylines and stuff.
So it's like being in an escape room or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And this review is really fascinating because it's like a big Star Wars fan, a big Disney World and amusement park fan.
That's a whole
named,
type of guy.
Jenny Nicholson is her name.
Okay.
And she seems to be one of the more thoughtful and honest reviewers of this genre. And she does a really good job of, you know, explaining what was good about it, what was bad about it, but also like how the experience could have been really amazing because, you know, it's all integrated into your smartphone and you've got like an RFID wristband. And she's like, there could have been an experience where all of the text that you're getting from the characters, when you respond to it, the characters know who you are from your wristband and like call you by name and know what side you're on. Cause there's these different storylines where you're supposed to join like the resistance or the Han Solo type smuggler.
So you're like
the
in
First
a
Order who are the fascists.
Live action role playing basically.
Yeah.
That's a cool idea.
It looks cool. It looks like Star Wars. And what I thought was really amazing about this review is that she wanted to join the First Order. She wanted to join the fascist regime. Not because she is a fascist. She
just likes discipline and authority.
She seems like fairly apolitical or maybe slightly to the left because she has a lot of sympathy with the workers at the hotel. But I thought it was really amazing that she goes to this hotel to try to join the fascist First Order, but the whole thing doesn't work. Like, it's already not as ambitious as what she had predicted. There's no connection between like the cell phone gameplay where the characters are texting you and the actual, like, you know, the environment that you can like minimally interact with and the actors. And it's like fairly random, like what path you get put on. And for her, it didn't work altogether. And I just thought it was an incredible, allegory for this reality we're living in where, like, well, if we don't want to be horrified all the time by what's happening in the world and in our own lives, we can retreat to the fantasy of culture and aesthetics.
Sure.
And, you know, Disney, since the 50s and even before that, has always been into this Imagineering concept of building this immersive reality where we can retreat into in a way that feels higher and better than our lived reality. And it just costs, you know, the amount that a middle-class family could afford to have that experience. And so she was trying to, like, give herself over to this fascist impulse of submitting to aesthetics, but she couldn't do it because it doesn't work.
Okay, so her suspension of disbelief failed. She wanted to be part of the First Order. See, I'm a episodes 4, 5, 6 guy because I'm an old person. I never got into the other ones. But, like,
they're all equally good, in my opinion.
Really? I tried to watch episode one.
It's not really
one.
My opinion, really like but it. It's such a contrarian opinion. Okay. That's what I'm going with.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll get some fan mail off of that one. But no, like, I mean, Star Wars wanting to join in this epic battle between good and evil, right? To be part of something higher, bigger than yourself, even if it is this fascist First Order or whatever, is a great respite from everyday life, right? Because it doesn't feel like there is that. There was the Resistance, I guess, for how many years ago was that now? 8 years ago? You could join the Resistance against the evil Emperor Donald Trump. But
and I mean, that's part of the what's so funny about it is like Lucas conceives of Star Wars as this allegory for Vietnam, right? Mm-hmm. Where like the rebels are the Viet Cong guerrillas. And then the Resistance is like that. For the sort of anti-fascist Popular Front era.
Right.
Of like the First Order is back, and now lovers of democracy and the Republic have to unite to fight it, even though the odds seem so dismal.
Right.
And, you know, you see even that like much lighter version of the Vietnam allegory seed into simple, you know, commodification where all of the forces are balanced, the villains and the heroes are more or less the same. And even when you try to engage in it on that level, it's all just aesthetics and a product that doesn't work. It's like a malfunctioning toy that you get shipped for Christmas.
So like the headline is that this lady did a 4-hour YouTube review of this thing. That is dedication to the cause.
It could have been longer, you know. It's she's very entertaining.
Isn't that really like the promise though of like liberal capitalism and bourgeois democracy, is that you can get like really, you can turn into a crank basically and like self progress and like find things in the world that you truly care about and just spend obsessive amounts of energy on it. I feel like this woman is like the haute petty bourgeois figure, and I support her enterprise. Oh, you want to play this video? So there's been a lot of shit talking about AI, and this is actually in preparation to announce a new little mini series that I'm going to be doing. Andy, you're more than welcome to join in on this, but we got Maddie Lubachansky and Jaya. We're going to maybe think about doing like an AI miniseries talking about the pitfalls of it, the potentials of it, talk about how it matches with this sort of ephemeral post-postmodern, post-industrial, financialized economy that we're in right now. So we welcome all of you on that journey. And Andy, if you have any good people to talk to, we want to talk to people in the arts, we want to talk to like doctors, we want
to talk
to people
Garrison Lovely, but we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, but the point is everybody's scared of AI, right? AI is this tool, and it's a tool potentially of oppression. Maybe it's also a tool of freedom, like all tools might be, right? So I think I found the best use case scenario for AI here. It's a video on YouTube. Let's listen to it. It's titled, I used AI to write a country song about drunk driving. Go.
All right. It's so much when I drink and drive. Drinking and driving, it makes me feel alive. And I think it is my favorite thing.
It gets better.
Buying 40 Bud Lights and turning off my headlights. Baby, we're totally not swerving. Let me see how many beers I can make.
DUIs are pretty special.
This is pretty funny for an AI. This is like the first time an AI has ever been funny.
Funny drives! He calls them funny drives.
Don't drink and drive.
Drink and drive, folks. If you've lost a family member to drink or driving, or those two of those things together, we're so sorry. But a drunk driving song written by AI is pretty good. So AI might be acceptable for writing really outro comedy. So it might have a place in this world.
Yeah, I have thought about using that program Sumo to write an Antifada theme song, because you can come up with like, you can, you know, write your own lyrics and make a song around it, but whenever I do AI stuff, people get really mad.
They get really mad, yeah.
Usually designers and people who like... But that's something I'm sure you'll address on the show.
Yeah, we can address it in the miniseries thing. Like, I don't know. Obviously, it's taking jobs away from people. But what under capitalism doesn't? That's like right. The entire point of the whole thing.
Yeah, it's just hard to say someone who is having their their wages cut back or losing gigs.
Absolutely.
Like, well, you know, this is how it always is.
This is how it goes.
The mechanists 150 years ago.
Yeah.
Happened to the telephone operators 100 years ago.
The horse-drawn carriage builders.
Now it's happening to you.
Yeah, now it's happening to you. It's coming for all of us someday.
Maybe you should be a little bit more creative.
Yeah, perhaps. Or perhaps just get really good at AI, and then you could be the 1 out of 10 people who doesn't lose their job in the creative industries. So that was the fun segment of our show. I can report back to all the listeners that having a great time at work these days. I tell you about the? I think I talked a little bit about it with Nasai on the stream, but I've got a nice job right now, man. Right off of my train, 35-minute commute, great gang. Not very physically hard, and even better than all of that, we're in a constant class struggle with the general contractor and the developer. So I get to hone various particular skills of trying to get their asses.
What is the job?
The job is deep foundation work. So we're letting the machine do the work. It's no swinging a hammer. It's just like basically feeding a big giant machine that's throwing steel 80 feet into the ground.
Another good allegory for our current times, feeding the machine.
Feeding the machine. You feed the machine and the steel goes in the ground.
Some of us feed the allegorical machine of the cultural industry, but you're feeding the real machine.
Yeah, it's all machines, man. It's machines all the way down. So the deal is this is a job for a big, without like self-doxing or starting a scandal, a big public utility in the New York City area, right? So these are people who have their own safety plans, they've got their own work rules, and they own the site, and they're running the job. And we have been, as I said, in a state of constant warfare from the beginning, not least because the super on our job with the company that we're with as a subcontractor is a lady. And so a lot of this started because of overt and covert misogyny on the part of the general contractor. And so they hit us and we hit them back. And having a great time with it, man, to be quite honest. They made our super cry, and that is unacceptable. You know what they said to her? They said, you know, maybe it's because of who you are, but you're letting these men, talking about us, get the better of you, basically implying, like, perhaps, like, if she wasn't a woman, she'd run the job better. So, you know, bosses aside, that's fucked up.
So it's your union steward is a woman, or the company
boss. Yeah.
Okay, so you're organizing against this lady, and you feel like you're working.
No, we're organizing with. It's like cross class collaboration here.
Okay.
We're going cross class. We're just trying to defend her from all these attacks, because the attacks end up landing on us too. Like, they tried to throw our shop steward off the job. We got the union involved, turned into a big fucking thing, and we want him back, which was great. And then in order to get them back, we found a little operation that they were doing that required two of our guys, but they only had one of them. So we called the president of the union, came down and fucking sorted them out. Then they retaliated us on a bunch of safety shit, like going above and beyond what was necessary. They were just trying
to shut us down, concern trolling us
on the job. And then they put like security things in. They wanted us to like not be able to change in our shandy. They wanted us to have to wear our hard hats out the door, and it's like a 5-minute walk to where we have to leave. So we absolutely rebelled over that and threatened to walk off. So it's been an interesting time, man.
So you're organizing with your fellow workers and
no, I mean, we're not, I wouldn't say we're organizing. We're like defending ourselves as a gang against the depredations of this company.
But there's good camaraderie.
We got a great gang going. I mean, it's like 6 weeks into a 4-month job. So of course, personality differences are coming out and there's a little bit of dead weight going on, but the foreman is an old buddy of mine from back in the day, and we reunited and now we're kicking ass. So like, we're already organized. It's about like a very like trade union consciousness defense of our dignity and rights on the job, their dignity to like, you know, be able to change and walk out of the door in t-shirt and shorts. I mean, what's the class struggle if not that, right?
So moving on to the broader class struggle, we've got some updates from Starbucks, from Amazon, from the UAW at the University of California. And I guess it's sort of an interesting juxtaposition, because you do have this sort of optimistic moment where the Teamsters are moving to this more militant direction, mm-hmm. And merging with Amazon in this case, which is a sort of a complicated thing. Maybe you got some insight about the particularities of that, but then hanging over all of its head is that the Supreme Court is, you know, chipping away at the power of the NLRB and possibly moving towards just defanging it altogether, if not abolishing it. So yeah, where would you want to start with that stuff?
Well, the ALU, the Amazon Labor Union, the Teamsters thing, I think is an interesting update, so people know what's going on over there. The contract negotiations are stalled. I mean, they haven't even really started yet. I don't think Amazon wants to recognize them at all. It's been a couple of years, right, since they won their vote in Staten Island, and not a lot of headway has been made. And so the exciting thing about ALU, and the reason why they were, part of the reason anyway, they were able to succeed, is not just they were great organizers and they could make a great case to the workers there in that Amazon facility, but also that they came from the rank and file themselves, and they like self-organized a union in their particular shop. Since then, obviously, there's been stubborn resistance from Amazon. A lot of resources that a large union like the Teamsters might have, or the UAW have, was lacking in this case. And a lot of, I think, institutional memory, right? Around the same time ALU organized, you also had the Teamsters independently doing a big drive to organize Amazon, because obviously a lot of that is in the logistics and distribution bailiwick, which is a Teamster thing too. So the Teamsters are not subsuming under this proposal, subsuming the ALU. The ALU is not going to become a Teamsters local or a union affiliated, or I guess like part of the Teamsters is going to be affiliated with the Teamsters alongside it. So it's ALU Teamsters Local One is the proposal. Problem with it right now is that while the Teamsters leadership voted for this association between them, the rank and file has not been able to vote yet in the Amazon Labor Union. And so this was presented as a fait accompli, kind of running roughshod over union democracy within the ALU.
So, and where does proletarian hero Chris Smalls stand in all of this?
Chris Smalls looks like he's potentially going to lose leadership vote that's coming up right
because
now.
Because he's sort of tried to forge as an autonomous union outside of the traditional big unions like the Teamsters. But there's been various accusations of mismanagement of funds, of mismanagement of union democracy, and not totally clear to me what's going on there, because this is all very internal stuff. But it looks like the ALU is moving more towards the traditional direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think it became clear after this sort of this headline victory that given the state of labor law in the country, given the legalized aspect, legalistic aspect of trade unionism and worker struggle, quote unquote, in the United States, seeing as though Amazon's got all this, these resources and certainly labor lawyers, anti-labor lawyers on their side, a lot of the mismanagement, I don't know too much about it, but it seems to come from disorganization. And if there's one thing the Teamsters have been doing for like 100 years or so, it's hiring lawyers, having a constitutional structure that leads to some sort of bureaucratic semi-democracy.
Yeah, you just got one person to run the spreadsheet and make the calls, and that way, you know, it gets done. It's not just someone who has to do that shit on their break or, you know, after 12 hours on the job.
Right, right. I mean, Alex Press would be, she was telling me like a year ago about all this insider stuff that's happening. She would be a great person to talk to about how this whole thing shook out. But I think it's interesting for us to look at the way that like big capital and the state and their mediation with the workers leads to, like, at least in the United States and probably elsewhere, massive constraints upon you know, union activity, union self-organization, and the capacity of a small independent group to break through with something beyond just an election, right? To be able to actually pull an organization together that can compete with the likes of Amazon.
Somewhat relatedly, there's the story from California where the UAW 4811 were ordered to stop their strike at the University of California campuses. And part of the the reason the judges sided with the UC administration on this is because of UAW members joining pickets during the pro-Palestinian camps. They had been, as far as I can tell, just from watching it from afar, a pretty big part of the defense of these camps, you know, stationing people sort of as security, blockading vehicle traffic at certain points.
With the pickets, right?
With pickets. And this was seen by the judge as evidence that the UAW is acting illegally or overly disruptively and was grounds to break the strike. And one commentator, somebody on Twitter, it looks like somebody who works for UAW or AFL.
This CM Lewis.
Right. He seemed to be framing it as like, this is an example of why unions shouldn't foray into politics because you're going to get yourself involved in these semi insurrectionary moments like at UCLA where you've got this like sort of fortified camp that has to fight off the police and agitators, and that weakens the labor struggle.
Right.
And the Starbucks case that the Supreme Court just ruled on, it's not exactly the same thing, but there's a similar aspect to it.
Right.
Where I haven't read the case itself, but it seems like the use of partisan media in like coming to a Starbucks after hours to promote the union was what they took issue with.
Yeah, and it's also cutting down on the NLRB's ability to reinstate workers who are hired for what's considered to be union activity.
So like assault.
Yeah.
So or if like Starbucks fires assault is someone who joins, who like gets a job at Starbucks as a union operative, basically. And so if this person was identified and fired for doing that, they don't have the same rights as a normal employee. Is that right?
No, whether they're coming from the outside to organize with a previously existing union or whether they're just like trying to start something on their own as a rank and file worker and say they're wearing like a union pin, right? That's considered to be protective union activity. But oftentimes employers, whether it's Starbucks or a factory or whatever, will see somebody with that union pin or see somebody talking or handing out literature during break or whatever and find some sort of excuse to fire them. Maybe they've been late one day, they're late a second time, and they use that as an excuse to fire them. That could be brought up then as a grievance in front of the NLRB, and that person can be reinstated for an indeterminate amount of time. And so what this Starbucks decision does is it cuts down the NLRB's ability to reinstate workers, you know, with, you know, after a review of the situation.
What would the pretense be for not reinstating them versus a normal reinstatement of like, you know, if you're sort of organically organizing, you would be reinstated. But if you're, I don't know, if you're identified as assault, you're not reinstated. Is that?
No, it's more like, I mean, you're looking at the media aspect of it, right? They brought a film crew into this Starbucks to do like a promotional video for the union. That happened. And then as I understand it, these people also, they got fired for that, but also other infractions too. So the NLRB reinstated them saying that this was protected union activity, right? To have this outside film crew come in after hours. And the Supreme Court just basically shot down the NLRB's right, I guess, as a judicial body to have them reinstated under these auspices.
I see.
Like, as I understand it, like wearing a union pen or giving out literature is one thing. That's like a concerted union activity. But having, as you said, like outside people coming into this to the store like during opening hours or after opening hours is considered like a violation that is a fireable offense, not protected under the NLRB. So it's like there's this battle that's been going on for decades, but really highlighted over the last 4 years as Biden's administration has tried to give more teeth to the National Labor Relations Board, make sure that there's more pro-union judges on it than none. And this goes back and forth depending on who the administration is. And so, you know, the anti-union forces, anti-worker forces within the judiciary, but then society at large, including Elon Musk, who with Tesla put up as an argument that the NLRB itself is unconstitutional, are finding this the battleground, right, in order to fight over workers' rights. It's not like, you know, a direct struggle between capital and labor per se. It's more like once a labor struggle gets up into these rarefied heights of this National Labor Relations Board, lower courts and the Supreme Court are then judging whether or not these new ways of encouraging workers to unionize are constitutional or not. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know the composition of the courts. And so this is like a way to chip away at any of the small ways in which the Democratic administration has been able to make it slightly easier for workers to organize under the NLRA, which is already, as we know, total dog shit.
So, but it seems like this decision, which was bipartisan, I think it was
8-1, yeah,
8-1, is still sort of within the framework of the purpose of the NLRA and NLRB, which is to basically stop workers and bosses from having like head-on violent yes. confrontations, like yeah. what they were doing in the 30s, instead of having workers have to arm themselves against Pinkertons and the police, you now had a legal route towards recognition.
Yeah, and settling grievances, right, back and forth.
So do you think we're still heading in a direction of the rolling back the clock to the 20s? Or do you think, well, I guess, you know, there's really no way to predict, because it's the sort of the same thing with all the Supreme Court decisions, like how far will the center right judges yeah. go? But does it seem like we're still on that route? Or do you think that maybe they'll wisely try to keep the constraints of the NLRA?
If they were wise, they certainly would, right? Because as we know, union density is like staying steady now after a long decline. And we see with the instance of Starbucks and the Amazon labor union we were just talking about, and the UAW losing the vote of that big Mercedes plant in Alabama, that the NLRA or NLRB, even under the quote-unquote most pro-union president in history, unions are still having a hard time organizing, right? And it remains this pressure valve, and it remains this legalistic instrument that, as you said, can like tamp down on instances of struggle and put them up into a rarefied sphere where it's lawyer on lawyer and it's not like worker on mm-hmm. capital or capital on worker, as the case may be. And we can't predict the future. You know, I think later on this episode, we're going to try to maybe speculate about what recent events mean towards, you know, for like the rise of a new regime of accumulation to replace neoliberalism in this messy process that we're going through right now. But I would say, you know, at this point, I assume Trump's going to win. It just seems like the most.
Yeah, hard to imagine. He wouldn't.
I mean, but again, you can't predict. Things.
It does. You know, everyone's saying it's a coin toss, but it just. My feeling is, you know, that yeah. Trump's going to win.
Under a Trump administration, I think certainly the right-wing forces, which are real, like, counter-revolutionaries, the ones who want to get rid of the progressive legacy, let's say, of the 20th century, might feel empowered to go full-court press. We might see a different judgment, say, on the lower courts and the Supreme Courts about the constitutionality of the Labor Relations Act. I feel like most trends are moving in that direction right now. And so we should certainly act right now and organize ourselves right now with the expectation that in our lifetimes, or maybe over the next 5 or 10 years, we might be operating in a completely different legal terrain when it comes to what were previously protected union activities and the mediation of the state in the unionization process or decertification process. Again, hard to predict, but I think we should start acting as though this is coming down the pipe and it's something we're going to have to face.
Yeah, I think certainly either way, it's the goal of a higher union density, more unions, stronger unions, more militant unions will put us in a better position for whatever they decide.
Yeah, I feel like One of the tasks maybe of the Independent Labor Club of North America is going to be to start imagining this future and imagining different ways to fight back from what very courageous and heroic people at that Amazon plant and in the Starbucks workshops have been doing for a while. They were organizing under certain conditions. If those radically change, then we need to radically change the way that we think of the class struggle and interface with current and new struggles.
Okay, so maybe we can move on from there, from the class war to the actual war.
Yeah, the war.
The non-class war in Russia and Ukraine.
Have you been following that war a lot?
You know, I listen to Radio War Nerd, and that's where most of my information comes from.
Is he good on it?
You know, I don't assume that everything they say is correct, but... you know, I think it's probably a better source of information than just Twitter or...
Oh, absolutely. Or the New York Times.
Yeah, I mean, you got to read the bias into everything, but they're entertaining at least.
The place that I find the most valuable updates and news from that war, which is, what, in its third year now, is through the sort of minority faction within the ruling order. In terms of foreign policy, which is the realist school, right? The Mersheimers. As long as you recognize that these people and the pundits that circle around them are like another faction of the blob, that they're like an insurgent, like theoretical and political band within the ruling class who wants to, of course, stop the war with Russia so they can begin the war with China. Right. As long as you recognize that, I feel like there's a lot of good information that you can get from these people. Alexander Makoris is one that I listen to. Not great views on a lot of things, but like I find that listening or watching people who actually like read the comparison between the news reports coming out on Russian Telegram and in Russian media versus what's coming out on Ukrainian Telegram and Western media is like probably... the truth lies somewhere in the middle. And one of the things, this happened, what, almost over 2 years ago, right? One of the headline things that happened was during the Istanbul Accords, which was meant to stop the war in May of 2022, before most of the hundreds of thousands of casualties had happened, when it appeared that on the table was going to be a compromise that could work for both Ukraine and Russia, which was no Ukraine in NATO, a referendum again in the occupied territories, and pulling back neutralization and demilitarization of Ukraine in favor of like a lasting peace in the region. That, of course, as we know now, was literally stymied, was literally shut down by Boris Johnson, who flew out there, and double down on the war with the Anglo-American basically plot or scheme to completely destroy the Russian economy through the sanctions regime and through isolating the economy. Boris Johnson and presumably Joe Biden thought that a continuation of the war could bring regime change to Russia, that Putin would fall if you strangled the Russian economy, made the people so immiserated and upset with their leadership and the war that they were prosecuting that they would overthrow him, right? That's always been like a headline thing for me, right? Like, why is it that they thought that they could strangle this, what John McCain famously called a gas station with a military? What made them think that they could strangle the Russian economy? They could kick them out of SWIFT. They could seize their assets. They could basically stop trade between Europe and Russia and the United States. What made them think that was going to work, and why didn't it work, right? Because these are interesting questions if we consider the way that the Western rulers consider the world economy to work. They clearly were not correct on that, right? Russia, in fact, its economy has bounced back. It's sealed this economic and political partnership with China, and its economy has actually grown. They're at like full employment and facing inflation because they have so many jobs. It's made me rethink the common narrative of the Russian Federation and that whole sphere. Post the collapse of the USSR, there's this common thing, and I still believe this is true to an extent, where with the rise of with like shock therapy in Russia, with the rise of figures like Yeltsin, you had what's considered like a looting of the Russian economy, right? Capitalists and bureaucrats coming in and buying up for really cheap shares of public corporations, leading to an oligarchic class that's merely bent on corruption and money making off the state, and that the whole enterprise was chaotic and didn't work for the Russian people. I mean, I think if you're the Russian ruling class, that certainly is the case, right? We know the epic consequences of what shock therapy meant, what that looting meant. But if you're Russian, part of the Russian ruling class, and we look now back 30 years later, what appeared to be this period of looting seems to me now to have been a transition within capital, right? A transition from Soviet state capital to Russian national capital, in which case, right, it's like what appears as looting is instead the consolidation of a national bourgeoisie with its own national interest, right? Fast forward 30 years now, and it appears that coming out of neoliberalism, the Russian economy, the Russian nation state, the Russian bourgeoisie is actually, through what we could call combined and uneven development, the fact that so many aspects of its major heavy industrial capacity have remained in state hands, especially its military, military-industrial complex, the fact that you have a nationalistic and nationally oriented bourgeoisie, which is very much tied to the state and Russian state projects, right? The project of the aggrandizement of the Ruski Mir, as they say. The fact that Russia has remained by and large a manufacturing and extractive economy, as opposed to like a post-industrial financialized economy like the United States. The fact that Russian national leadership has kept debt levels very, very low and mostly relied on production and export, you know, as opposed to, of course, the American model, having been able through political means to keep that American model, to keep the internationalization of Russian capital at bay, means that due to the crisis of 2008, and now we're what, how many years? We're 12 years down the line from that, with the terminal crisis of the neoliberal regime of accumulation, due to combined and uneven development, now that there's a deglobalization, now that there's like the creation of capitalist power blocks, the rise of tariffs in the United States and elsewhere, now it appears that Russia, with its backwards economy, with its economy that's not financialized, that's not open, that's not free, is now in a better position to weather this economic crisis than the United States is. And I think we see that in many events. And so you have a situation where it was exactly that backwardness of the Russian bourgeoisie, the Russian state, the Russian economy, that's now going to allow it to like set the pace, perhaps. And China and Russia will be able to do things, the important things that figures of the 1930s did in the world during that Great Depression, that global capitalist crisis, the sort of things that such luminaries as Roosevelt, Stalin, and Hitler were able to do. Joe Biden has shown he is incapable of doing that, but Putin and Xi may be able to.
We're essentially talking about Keynesianism, or like a military Keynesianism.
Yeah, military Keynesianism, exactly.
And so, yeah, this has been a key way that Russia's weathered these sanctions, is through being cut off from the world economy. It's been able to internalize through its own pretty adept financial policies into creating a war economy where wages are actually going up,
yep,
where they're able to produce a massive amount of artillery that overwhelms the Ukraine, which is not able to produce artillery and
certainly
is not
West
able
can.
To have any kind of economy. It's just completely development dependent on the cash coming in from the United States or from the EU, which I think just gave them a massive
$50 billion,
massive loan. But so you're contending that the ability of Putin to shift so successfully to military Keynesianism, and which is still, he still has some challenges in this. There was recently the imposition of these second order sanctions, where now doing business with Russia opens up people to having their assets seized. Mm-hmm. And I think even that major loan from the EU is going to be paid for by the interest on seized Russian assets.
Which is an incredible gambit on the part of the global capitalist financial elite, because the knockoff effects of that could be horrible for the US dollar and for treasuries and the euro and the European financial system.
Why is that exactly?
Well, because it's illegal under their own laws. Like, you can't, that's like me stealing your car and then like renting it out, and you're like, well, come on, man, like, that's my car.
Stealing
your
car to do Uber.
To do Uber with, right. Yeah, exactly. And then taking the proceeds from that out of it.
What would Russia sue the EU in, like, the International Criminal Court or
big
what?
Big time, yeah. I don't know what court is in charge of that.
There's probably some financial court.
The reason they didn't seize that $300 billion directly is that it's illegal. And now this new workaround is also illegal, but they think they can get away with it in European courts. The lawsuits will be going on for years, right? These are sovereign assets that were stolen. I don't give a shit one way or the other, but the point of it is that in all of these efforts, and this is true in the Gaza war as well, the rules-based international order, which, of course, as we know, has a strong financial component, has proven itself to not just be hypocritical, but ultimately self-defeating in a lot of the things that it's trying to do, right? Standing up for the rules-based international order, but then allowing Israel to commit genocide, you know, to allow Israel to flout the UN, the International Court of Justice. It all just shows, like, the crumbling of, if not the ideology, then certainly the reality of, like, a rules-based American hegemonic order where, like, if sovereign nation states play the rules of the game, you know, then they'll have the ability to have sovereignty and all that good shit, so...
It seems like, and this maybe goes back to the 4 hour Star Wars video a bit, but there's this question of competency that has become more and more central towards these sort of international conflagrations, whether it be financial or war or political, where you see Putin withstanding this through the installation of very competent bureaucrats. Mm-hmm. And certainly China as well has sort of like asserted itself as this highly competent actor. You know, whether that not that's true is yet to be seen, really. I mean, they've got their own problems too. And then, of course, the EU was sort of established as this beacon of bureaucratic competence.
Sure.
And management. Yeah. With, you know, the always elevating the best name people, and like not what we do in the United States, where we just sort of, maybe with the exception of the Fed, like, which also, you know, installed psychos like Greenspan. Yeah. But I think we're reaching the point in the United States where, like, you know, Trump is our Putin. Trump is supposed to be the competent one against
senile,
feeble, weak,
yeah,
Joe and his own blob, which is increasingly looking like Democratic operatives who don't really have any political vision or ideal. They're just sort of going through the motions of, well, we said we support Ukraine. We've always been about containing Russia and punishing Russia. And the obvious contradictions with what's going on in Israel, notwithstanding, like, they have to just keep doubling down on this strategy that's clearly not working, is clearly becoming threadbare, whereas someone like Trump will cut a deal, you know?
Yeah, allegedly, yeah, he'll cut it. He said he'll end the Ukraine war on day one. I mean, whether that's possible, because I think that the investment of treasure and Ukrainian blood, certainly more and more of that every day, does serve interests of, like, a, let's call them, a foreign policy clique within the State Department and the Pentagon. Let's
and
also
the military industrial complex.
And the profit driven military industrial complex. You can't get any more blood from that stone in the United States, right? Of the military industrial. We've been doing military Keynesianism since the 1950s, late 40s, early 50s. And so, like, that whole industry has gone through various transformations, and under Bill Clinton was forced to decentralize, right? I should say centralize under like four or five big names. Russia's got like one big name, and like the difference between Russian capitalism and say EU capitalism when it comes to the war economy especially, and maybe more broadly, is that one of the big problems that NATO countries are facing as independent, you know, members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and as member states of the European Union, is that they all have non-interoperability between all of their different tanks and airplanes and shit like that, because they're all trying to maintain their own indigenous, local, national military defense industry, right? Whereas Russia doesn't have that problem and China doesn't have that problem. One other key thing that we look at, maybe understanding what's happening with Russia as like perhaps part of this new transition to a new regime of accumulation. And to define that, those are just basically the rules under, say, neoliberalism or Fordism or progressive capitalism or laissez-faire capitalism, the rules and regulations through which capital accumulates. And these things change historically. With the end of neoliberalism, it won't be the end. It will be neoliberalism will be sublated by some new sort of contradictory arrangement that might last similarly like another 30, 40 years or whatever, if capitalism continues, if this war doesn't blow all of us up in a nuclear conflagration, is that Russia, the other thing that Russia was able to do was by putting up high tariffs. And by the way, did you see the Trump proposal the other day on tariffs?
Yeah, no income tax, just tariffs.
Just 30 or 40% tariffs. Like, remember Hillary and Obama in 2008, Obama kept like calling Hillary like old news. Like, we don't want these old Democrats who are just like that old Clintonianism, he said. And then Hillary Clinton came back and said, I'm a change agent, right? That was her big thing against Obama, is like, she actually will be able to get in there and change things. Trump is an actual change agent. I'm not saying that he can put these tariffs through, right? But like, there's a way in which, similar to like Carter and Volcker, that like what happens in the next Trump administration will be very interesting to watch in terms of the new regime of accumulation that's popping off. But part of the other really big thing is tariffs, right? So Russia's competent technocrats, as you said, were able to design an anti-sanctions regime that stopped capital flight, and were able to actually parlay when Western corporations, whether like tire companies or Starbucks or McDonald's, all of a sudden started pulling out. They started seizing them and they started basically selling them off to their indigenous capitalists and rebranding them under like some Russian name or whatever. That has been part of this virtuous cycle in Russia and has shown that like a sort of neo-autarchic sort of with like an export regime as well, neo-autarchic national economy with an export regime is possible in this post-neoliberal era. And so the question is like, what'll be the knock-on effect of this? Like, will Russia, maybe for people like Trump, you know, or people like Le Pen, or people in the Alternative for Deutschland or whatever, will this be a signal for them that like another world is possible for capital? You know, will this like process, slow process of de-globalization or friendshoring or renationalizing of industry, is Russia actually going to be ahead of the game exactly because it is the subject of being cut off from the rules-based international order? And what does that do to a rules-based international order, i.e. U.S. hegemony, which is already crumbling? Like, the reason why, as you said before, these people seem so incompetent is because you've got the Anthony Blinkens of the world, and you've got the Jake Sullivans of the world. You've got, who's the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Austin, Lloyd Austin's of the world, flying around the Middle East, coming up with solutions that might have worked 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago at the height of American power, but no longer work anymore. They're incompetent because, like, the limits set on American action are such that they haven't synthesized them yet, and they're still trying to do things that they used to could. You know?
Yeah, that seems about right. And I mean, the writing was on the wall, I think, for a long time when Obama's position against settlements in Israel for in the West Bank, for example, was pretty firm, but just was they're powerless to do anything about it. And then Trump and Biden come in and just have to accept that new reality without any attempt at rolling it back through any sort of force. And that's put us in the situation we're in right now, where Israel is just seeing how far it can go. And it's gone pretty far, and it's still unclear what or how Biden or Trump will ever rein it in.
Yeah, I mean, it shows, you know, what do they call it, the international community? It shows the toothlessness of that. And it's like everybody and their mother, like ruling classes from all over the world, are condemning what Israel's doing and trying to put pressure on our ruling class to make it stop, and it's just impossible to do so. I mean, this is all very speculative, right? I was just thinking about trying to reframe the way we look at the history of Russia in the last 30 years, trying to understand how it is that, like, American economists thought that this would work in one way and it worked completely the other way. And I think that it matches with, I think, all of our rightful skepticism about economics, our rightful skepticism of, like, a capitalist ruling class in an increasingly chaotic world, to, like, even understand the terrain that they're struggling on, the terrain that they're fighting on. This incompetence thing that you talk about is really real. I mean, Joe Biden's brain is literally like soup, and it's pouring out of his ears at this point in time. And that is like the epiphenomenon of a larger phenomenon, which is that, like, always the ruling classes are like on the edge of disaster, sometimes more so than others. Certainly in 2008, they were. Certainly in 2016, with Trump rising, there was like a huge sort of immune effect, you know, that popped in trying to manage the chaos of that. But, like, more and more, it seems they can't do it. More and more, other options like Putin and his national bourgeoisie, his quote-unquote oligarchy, that's what we call them when they're in Russia or elsewhere, right? More and more, they're becoming the adults in the room in, like, this dying, shitting, decaying capitalist order. And this all presumes that Russia can keep these balls up in the air. You know, we all know the limits of military Keynesianism because we ran into them in this country, you know, decades and decades ago, right? Like, the ruble is also declining at this point in time. There's been, like, talks of the Russian economy overheating, but, like, that's a story for another day. Now we want to, I think, try to speculate about what the next regime of accumulation might be, some weird synthesis of, like, the New Deal order and neoliberalism, because obviously that's the terrain on which we're going to struggle, right? And we're going to fight. We're going to theorize and do practical activity. So if we end up in a situation where more and more of the world looks like Russia, how do we imagine, like, the independent labor club or trade unions or whatever other groups it is we're involved in operating under these new conditions?
And so the final topic we want to talk about today, and maybe we should take this past the paywall, is the sort of ongoing fallout from the pandemic in terms of how the U.S. managed it in terms of public health, and how it managed public health internationally.
Yeah.
Talking specifically about this really disturbing story that the U.S. military ran a propaganda campaign in the Philippines against encouraging people not to get vaccinated with the Chinese vaccine.
Yeah. Sinovac. Yeah, there's a lot here. And I think that, like, personally, me, I'll talk about some lessons maybe that we've learned from the whole COVID experience that we can maybe take forward, so that when the next big crisis comes, we're not torn apart by, like, Pentagon propaganda or Fauci propaganda or anti-vax propaganda, right, or whatever it is, like all these different ways in which we were pulled in different directions that didn't make us any safer and made our theoretical apparatus much weaker. So we'll be on the other side of the paywall for that, folks. Yep.
Patreon.com/theAntifada. You could subscribe for $5 a month, for $10 a month, or we always appreciate people subscribing for the whole year. You get a 17% discount if you do that, and we'll talk to you on the other side of the wall.
See you there, folks.